This is Radioactive, a grassroots environmental and social justice news journal with Amy Brown and Meredith DeFrancesco for April 29th, 2010. Today we hear Robert Shetterly interview 9/11 scholar and author David Ray Griffin. He will be speaking in Maine May 5th. David Ray Griffin is considered one of the leading critics in the 9/11 truth movement. In their interview with David Ray Griffin, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation writes, quote, through his investigation and analysis of the fall of the Twin Towers and the mysterious collapse of the World Trade Center 7, the attack on the Pentagon, and the final 9/11 Commission report, Griffin continues to raise provocative questions about the inconsistencies and contradictions of the official version of the events of September 11, 2001, end quote. David Ray Griffin is the author of a number of books on the issue, including The New Pearl Harbor, Disturbing Questions About the Bush Administration and 9/11, and his most recent book, The Mysterious Collapse of World Trade Center 7, Why the Final Official Report About 9/11 is Unscientific and False. Today we play part of Robert Shetterly's interview with Griffin. The remaining half hour can be heard online at weru.org. Robert Shetterly is an acclaimed artist and activist, known in particular for his portrait series called Americans Who Tell the Truth.
Hello, I'm Robert Shetterly, and we are today in the Orland studios of WERU, and we have the great honor of speaking with Dr. David Ray Griffin. Dr. Griffin is a professor emeritus from the Claremont School of Theology in Claremont, California. He's been a professor of religion and theology for a long time, written some 25 books on subjects involving religion and theology. But that all changed about 8 years ago when he wanted to write a book about why 9/11 happened, and particularly in terms of what is called often blowback, meaning response to American foreign policy and intelligence policy, that those were probably some of the reasons that led to the attacks on the United States. And in the process, he discovered something much darker and deeper. And so I guess the first question that I would like to ask Dr. Griffin is about that involvement, you know, what he began to discover when he began to look into 9/11 and why he decided to follow it.
Well, like a lot of people, I did accept the blowback thesis, really out of ignorance, because I didn't know about things relevant to 9/11. I didn't know about standard operating procedures for intercepting airplanes that were hijacked or otherwise in trouble. You know, I didn't know this was highly rehearsed and that planes couldn't go flying around for more than 5 or 8 minutes at the most without being intercepted. I didn't know about steel frame high-rise buildings, that there's no way they could come down just because they got hit by planes and had some pretty good fires in them, and so on. So I had accepted the theory, and I'd been working on a book on global democracy, and after 9/11, I realized, well, every chapter dealt with American imperialism, but sort of implicitly, that it was a big problem. So I realized, well, I should have a chapter on that in itself. So I started writing a chapter on that. And of course, once you get into American imperialism, there's no end to it. It goes back a long way. And so I realized, well, that wasn't going to be a chapter. That was going to be another book. So I had that book almost three-fourths written. When then, actually a year after 9/11, a guy introduced me to the idea that 9/11 had been an inside job. And I thought, well, that's interesting. It's possible, but I don't believe it. But show me the evidence. And he sent me some websites. I looked at them and did not find it convincing. Now, I mention that because a lot of our critics will say, oh, you conspiracy theorists, you were just looking for something. You hated George Bush, and So you just wanted to blame them, so you found a couple facts that could maybe support that. Well, no, it was not that way at all. It was, I was reluctant to believe it. And it was finally then, another 6 months later, somebody else sent me some other evidence. In fact, it was the 9/11 timeline that Paul Thompson had put together, made up entirely of mainstream news stories that contradicted some aspect of the official story. And it only took me, I think, a couple days reading through that to see something was terribly wrong. So that's how I got started.
Dr. Riffin, I failed to mention that one reason we're doing this interview is that you're going to be speaking in Maine on May 5th at the Reach Center on Deer Isle, and on May 6th at the Luther Bonney Auditorium at the University of Southern Maine in Portland. Both talks are at 7 o'clock, and the title of your talk is the War in Afghanistan Justified by 9/11?
That's right. And when I started my work, of course, this war had been going on for some time, and the war in Iraq had just started. And so my first presentation was actually on, is the war in Iraq justified by 9/11? And I argued that it wasn't. So now, now that we've agreed that war, sort of agreed that war should come to an end, this one is still not only going strong, but stronger. But nevertheless, it's the same pretext Obama is using, as the Bush administration did, that we have to be there. It's not a war of choice. It's a war of necessity because we were attacked by people from Afghanistan on 9/11.
From reading your books, it becomes more and more problematic on about just who did attack us. Who were the people planning it? Who were the people in the planes? How was Pakistan involved and the ISI there? How was this whole thing engineered? And I'd be interested if you wanted to talk just a little bit about that. I know it can go in so many different directions, but
actually try to answer that question. The question I focus on is simply, is the official story true or false?
Mm-hmm.
And we're to the point now in, when I first wrote the first book, The New Pearl Harbor, I was saying, well, there's a very strong prima facie case that the official story is false. But my mind is still open. Maybe the 9/11 Commission can answer all these questions. And by the time the 9/11 Commission wrote, and I wrote my second book, which was a critique of that report, I was virtually certain it was false and that it was a massive cover-up. But now we're to the point where we can just talk about scientific proof, and I will talk about that there, primarily about Building 7 of the World mm-hmm. Trade Center, that the scientific evidence about it is just so overwhelming that we're not just talking now about possibly false or virtually certain is false. We're absolutely certain. There's just no doubt about it anymore. And so it's just a matter of getting the facts out. Once people see the empirical facts about how the building came down and the nature of the stuff in the dust, and that NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, which wrote the final official report, which came out at the end of 2008, that it even admitted that the building came down in absolute free fall for over 2 seconds. There's what I'm talking about, scientific proof.
We'll talk a little bit more about that then. Say, let's talk about some of the details. For instance, talk about steel and what it takes to melt steel and then get on to thermite and things like that.
Yeah, with this operation, they did what they do on a lot of these phony things. They put out a story at the beginning that, well, because they know the main thing is just to get the majority of people to believe it, get a certain image in their mind, and get it to the point where then if somebody questions them, they don't want to hear it. And in fact, they just roll their eyes and say, oh, we know that's settled. So they they put out stories. They even had statements allegedly by engineers saying, oh, the fires, those jet fuel fires, they were so hot. There's no way the steel could resist. The steel just melted, so the buildings came down. Well, that's just nonsense. Steel doesn't melt till about 2,700 degrees Fahrenheit. The fires in the building were not over 1,300 or 1,400 degrees. Diffuse open building fires cannot possibly get over 1,800 degrees Fahrenheit. So we're talking about almost 1,000 degrees difference. And yet a lot of people still think, oh, the steel melted, that's why the buildings came down. And but now, you know, NIST, when its report said, well, of course, the fire didn't melt the steel and so on, chuckle, chuckle. And, you know, all those dumb people out there believing it, we're not saying that. But they give actually an equally ridiculous theory about why the building came down.
What's their theory?
Well, with the towers, it's that the planes went into the buildings, created a big hole, and then after the fires started, and you did have some big fires there, the top part of the building, then because of that big hole, you got to remember the airplane is fairly small compared to that huge those huge twin towers. But nevertheless, that is a theory. You got that big hole there, and so the top part of the building fell down on the lower part of the building, and it just couldn't resist. And they just, all those floors just went tumbling down. I mean, not tumbling, just crashed straight down through the region of greatest resistance, all that steel. And remember, there were not fires down there in the lower floors, so that steel in the lower floors wouldn't have even been weakened. You've got 287 steel columns holding the building up. You've got 47 of those are really massive core columns. The idea that the top part of the building coming down the lower part of the building could have caused the whole thing to collapse is just scientifically absurd. For people who don't, you know, aren't familiar with these buildings, like I'm not, I use an analogy. Let's say you're driving down the freeway in your little sports car, and you get distracted, and you're going 80 miles an hour, and you don't notice this big semi-truck is parked on the freeway, and you run right into the back of it. Your little car starts pushing that semi down the freeway at 80 miles an hour. Now, we all know that couldn't happen, but that's essentially NIST's theory of how the Twin Towers came down.
Hmm. Well, they did come down. And there was a huge weight coming down on them, but then what made the bottom collapse?
That could have only happened because of explosives. You had to have some sort of explosives planted through the building on various floors. The steel came down in lengths of about 25 to 40 feet long. So that gives you an idea that every few floors you had explosives to cut the steel. The evidence for that explosives were used, first of all, you just got the phenomenological fact. You can see when you watch the buildings coming down, they're just it's just coming down at almost free fall acceleration. And you've got all the signs of a regular controlled demolition, the kind called implosion, where you take out the lower parts and the building collapses in on itself. That's more true of Building 7. It's more the classic one. With building the towers, they had to make it appear like it was the planes and the fires at the top. So the explosions actually, the visible explosions occurred at the top, although we know explosions were going off in the basements and the sub-basements also. But in any case, the scientific proof of that is in the dust. And there's a recent paper published by a group that Stephen Jones got started, chemists and physicists studying the dust. They had gotten four different samples of World Trade Center dust that had been collected in so early and in ways that it could not have been contaminated. And it had nanothermite in it, a lot of nanothermite. And ordinary thermite, is an incendiary, which has been around for about 100 years. But nanothermite is a high explosive as well as an incendiary, and it's only been around, as far as we know, since the 90s, probably.
And isn't this made with aluminum and dust and rust and then sulfur added to it that makes it burn like
The you don't necessarily need the sulfur with the nanothermite. That's when you add sulfur to ordinary thermite, you get thermate.
Mm-hmm.
And that was evidently a big part of what was going on, because there was discovered a piece of steel from one of the towers and one from Building 7, even though NIST later lied and said, oh, we couldn't find any steel that we could identify from Building 7. Even though this was found by three professors at Worcester Polytechnic Institute, and they reported that this piece of steel, which was like an inch thick, had big holes in it. It had been so thinned, and in some places there were holes in it, so it looked like a piece of Swiss cheese. And they said it was sulfidized, that there was sulfur in the intergranular structure of the steel. So that means it had to happen at an extremely high temperature. You know, it wasn't sulfur from the wallboard that just kind of fell on the steel, the way that NIST would try to make you believe. And this was reported in the appendix to the FEMA report, which was the first official report that came out on the World Trade Center in 2002. And the scientists reported this piece of steel, documented it, described it in great technical language, but they ended up by saying this requires further study. Now, when NIST took over from FEMA the task of putting out the official reports, the head of NIST said, we will take all the recommendations in the FEMA report. But they didn't take this one. They just ignored it, and as I said, even lied, saying that no steel had been identified from Building 7. So that was clearly, it seems like that was clearly a sulfate that did that. But the nanothermite is not just an incendiary. The sulfur in the sulfate, by the way, it just greatly reduces the temperature at which steel will melt, so it makes it much easier. But nanothermite is a whole different thing, whereas somebody did a demonstration and showing that thermite, if you put it on the engine of your car, will burn through the engine. You put the nanothermite on there, it'll blow the whole thing up. So it is an extremely powerful explosive, and what they found, this study, and this was published in a peer-reviewed scientific journal, physical chemical journal, that they had unreacted thermite, nanothermite, meaning that if they put a match to it, it would explode. So here you've got unexploded explosive material there in the dust of the World Trade Center. Now, some people will say, oh, well, this is truther science. Those guys were all 9/11 truthers, so how can we trust them? Well, go back to the R.J. Lee Group report. Deutsche Bank was, of course, right next door to the World Trade Center, just across the street, got heavily polluted, and they asked their insurance company to pay up. Insurance company wouldn't pay up. They said, oh, that's just ordinary building dust, not from the World Trade Center event. So they hired this regular, standard, well-known research group called the R.J. Lee Group. They came in, studied the dust, and said, this is definitely from the World Trade Center. It has what we call the World Trade Center signature, which includes a lot of iron, meaning the iron pellets So we're talking about very tiny particles of iron that are circular, meaning that they have melted, they've gone into the air and formed a circular shape. Sometimes they're called spherules. And not only that, they found that the dust was almost 6% iron. That is astounding. Ordinary building dust is like, what, 0.04% iron. So we've got a massive amount of iron here. And this was reported in reports that came out in 2003, 2004.
And that iron could have only been from nanothermite.
Well, it could only be from something that had heated
melted the steel and iron.
The steel up to a great temperature. And when you use thermite, whether it's ordinary thermite or thermate or nanothermite, it turns the steel, the iron is a byproduct. So iron is a pretty telltale sign. Previously melted iron is a pretty telltale sign that thermite of some sort has been used.
And weren't, for up to several weeks afterward, the buildings came down, I mean, the buildings 1 and 2 and then number 7, there was molten steel in the, in the wreckage for a long, long time, which means that this thermite, nanothermite was continuing to burn. Is that correct?
Yes, and you've got actually two signs of that. One is the molten steel, which was probably, everybody there called it steel. It was probably iron by then. But NIST knew they couldn't handle this, so they just denied it. You go on the video, go on Google, and you can see a video of John Gross, who was one of the major authors of the NIST reports, talking to a group, and somebody raises this question about all this molten steel. And he just denied the premise. He says, I don't think there wasn't any. I don't know of any credible person who said anything. Well, there were about 8 very credible people. I quote them in my various books, most certainly in this last book, the Mysterious Collapse of World Trade Center 7. And he just denied it. And so that's all NIST can do, because there are a whole host of facts they can't deal with. Now, another sign of this continuing burning was the fact that you had a tremendous heat in the ground and periodic emissions from the ground of very dangerous toxic gases. Going on for at least 2 months after the event, even though they were pumping enormous quantities of water and fire retardant foam to the rubble, they could not put that fire out. Now, a big mystery was, how could that underground fire be burning? Fire normally needs oxygen. How could it be getting oxygen down there? Well, the answer is, and I discuss this in the Mysterious Collapse book, that nanothermite provides its own oxidant. So it can just keep burning away, and you can put fire retardant, you can put water on it, it just going to keep burning away till it burns up all its fuel. So it's self-propelling.
Well, I have a couple of other questions regarding that. You mentioned that these explosions in the two main towers and Tower 7 were visible. There must have been witnesses then who either saw it or filmed it or heard it. Who are some of those people, and why haven't they been listened to more?
Well, as to why they haven't been listened to more, you'll have to ask the mainstream press. You'll have to ask the White House, you'll have to ask NIST, you'll have to ask the 9/11 Commission. They all know this because the majority of the people who gave such testimonies were members of the New York City Fire Department. And they were asked to come in and give oral testimonies shortly after 9/11, before their memories had faded or gotten too polluted. and tell, and they were never asked, did you hear explosions? But 118 of them clearly volunteered. This was out of 500. Clearly volunteered that they heard explosions. They were very puzzled by these things. And some of them would say, well, it's just like when you watch on TV, you see all these explosions, you know, you see the explosions going off, you hear the explosions, bang, 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 and then it comes down floor after floor after floor. So I had put out an article. Here, the story on this was that those got repressed. The city of New York would not release them. Here we're talking about Mayor Bloomberg, who had replaced Mayor Giuliani by then, and he refused to release them. There was a suit by both the New York Times, to its credit, the one good thing it has done in relation to 9/11, and some of the 9/11 family members. And court after court turned them down. They finally got to the highest state court in New York, the New York State Supreme Court, and they said, you've got to release these. This is public information. You've got to release it. So it was released, and the New York Times put it on its website. It never wrote a story, never wrote a single story about all these explosions, but nevertheless, it did make it available. And so the 9/11 Truth community got access to those, and one very unselfish fellow, a very good researcher, did a lot of work on it, sent it all to me, and I wrote up a story called Explosive Testimony that became one of the biggest, most viewed things on the web of all time, evidently, I was told. In any case, it had a very important effect. I was giving an interview about it on Guns and Butter in San Francisco Bay Area Pacifica Station, and there was an architect, a Republican architect, driving down the freeway, and he happened to turn to that station that day and started hearing this interview and heard me reading some of these testimonies by the fire department members, and some of them are very dramatic, and he got to shaking. He had to pull off the road and stop his car and listen to these, and went home and said, I've got to do research on this. This was 2006. He's an architect. He had never heard of any of this.
Is this Richard Gage you're talking
and
about?
And this was Richard Gage. Mm-hmm. And so he's the one who began Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, which now has almost 1,200 licensed architects and engineers who've signed a petition saying, official story stinks, I'm paraphrasing, we need a new investigation.
I'm Robert Shetterly, and we're at WERU, and we're talking today with Dr. David Ray Griffin, who many people consider the world's leading critic of the official story about 9/11. And he's going to be speaking here in Maine at two places, on May 5th at the Reach Center at 7 p.m. That's on Deer Isle. And on May 6th at the Luther Bonney Auditorium at the University of Southern Maine in Portland. And I hope a lot of you who are listening to this will be so moved to come and listen to him speak, because having read a number of his books myself, we are just scratching the surface of some of the complexities and confusions and facts about 9/11 and what might have really happened.
You've been listening to Radioactive, a grassroots environmental and social justice news journal with Amy Brown and Meredith DeFrancesco. Again, you can hear the remainder of Robert Shetterly's interview with David Ray Griffin and other archives at weru.org.